Tonight we want to continue our discussion of the survey of the Bible. Would ask you to take your Bibles and turn them to the book of Leviticus. The book of Leviticus. Whenever we talk about the Old Testament, and we talk about the Pentateuch, which are the first five books of the Old Testament, you know, the book of Genesis talking about the beginning, and the book of Exodus talking about the leaving in the land of Egypt and the building of the nation and the fulfillment of promise and giving of the law and the tabernacle, and all those things have some interest and historical value, and they're interesting from various standpoints. But two of the books that we often do not give much attention to are the books of Leviticus and Numbers. And yet they are part of the Pentateuch. And you remember in our Bible study, we are talking about getting the complete picture of understanding how all the dots are connected. And the book of Leviticus and the book of Numbers fills in some information that makes the Bible picture of the scheme of redemption much clearer. And so we want to look at those books tonight. We're going to look at Leviticus, and then we're going to begin to look at the book of Numbers, and we will conclude our looking at Numbers, Lord willing, next Sunday evening when we discuss the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Leviticus. The Old Testament book of Leviticus is concerning the laws governing the priesthood and the census in the book of Numbers. Leviticus is really about the priesthood. It is the tribe that God chose of all the 12 tribes to be the priestly clan, to be the priestly tribe. Their responsibility was to take care of the tabernacle, to be able to do all of its functions and do all of its work, to set it up, to tear it down, to transport it. All of it was taken care of by the Levitical tribes. And within the Levitical priesthood, there were three different families. And when you discuss the book of Leviticus, and when you study it, you will find that each one of these families had a particular role in the governing of the tabernacle. Some of them were responsible for the sacred articles. Others of the family were responsible to take down the articles. And then another family was charged with the responsibility of transporting it and to set it up when they moved to a new camping place. And so all of those details are given in the book of Leviticus. The book of Leviticus is the third book written by Moses, and the word itself means pertaining to the Levites, because that's who the book is addressed to. It is addressed to the Levitical priest. And it records the work of the Levites that are appointed in serving of the tabernacle. Now, this work will be expanded later, in later portions, especially in Deuteronomy, when we get further down in the history and we go to temple worship. But even in temple worship, many of the same responsibilities that are given in the book of Leviticus will still be maintained by the tribe of Levi. But the one thing that will change is the transporting of the tabernacle. The transporting of the tabernacle is not a permanent place. It is a temporary dwelling place. And so it had to be torn down and put together. That will not be so in the temple. The temple will be in one place. And so that part of the work will greatly change. We also see that in the book of Leviticus, the events and the laws contained in the book transpire during Israel's encampment at Mount Sinai. Now, the things that you read in the book of Leviticus take place during that time that they are camped on Mount Sinai, the time that they're going to receive the law, the time that they're going to begin to give the instructions of the law of Moses as they begin their journey. They started to go to the promised land, but of course that will get derailed thanks to their own disobedience and their unbelief. So what do we read about in the book of Leviticus? Well, in the book of Leviticus, it's really about law. The book of Leviticus is about law governing the job and the responsibilities of the Levites and how those responsibilities affect the people of God. And so in this book, we have laws containing several different types of offerings. Now, when you read the book of Leviticus, you can read about all the offerings that were offered by the Levitical priesthood. You have the burnt offering that were offered every day, morning and evening. You have the peace offering, the sin offering, trespass offerings, meal offerings, and on it goes. If you wonder why the Levitical priesthood was given no other responsibility than taking care of the temple worship and all the things that were attributed to it, you just study the book of Leviticus. They're going to be quite busy. You know why? Because every sacrifice that is offered by the people to God has to go through the Levites. All of it has to go through the priestly clan. And if you wonder why today some religions like Roman Catholicism, where they get the distinction between clergy and laity, they get it from Leviticus. Because there was a real distinction in the Old Testament between what we would refer to as clergy, which would be the priestly Levites, and the laity, which would be the children of Israel. And so in the old law, under the law of Moses, under the Pentateuch, there was this distinction. There was this clergy and laity system. But that died, of course, and that was done away with when the law of Moses was set aside at the coming of the death of Christ upon the cross. And so we have all the different offerings, what they were to offer, when they were to offer them, how they were to offer them, draining of the blood, and all those things are given in the book of Leviticus. We also have the priest's functions during each offering. Each offering is not the same. Sometimes they offer a certain part of the animal. Another time they offer a different part. We also God provided in that law that if they could not afford, certain things like lamb and bullocks, they could offer turtle doves. They could offer something of less value that would be more available to them and more affordable to them. So God had that within the law. We also see in the book of Leviticus the priest portions of the offering. Remember, the Levitical priesthood did not work outside. And so their livelihood was provided by the offerings that were given in the tabernacle. A portion of what was given was offered to the Lord. Another portion belonged to the priestly family. It was their sustenance in order that they might live. And when they go in, we will find out later, when they get into the inheritance, God takes care of them because He does not give them land, He gives them cities. And so all along, God takes care of the tribe of Levi for the work that they are doing pertaining to the priesthood. It talks about clean and unclean animals. In the book of Leviticus, there is a section that talks about the animals that God considered clean and those that He considered unclean. And the Levitical priests have to know that list. They had to be able to tell the distinction between that which was clean, that which was unclean, that which was holy, and that which was defiled and unholy. And that's one of the reasons that the Levites were strictly forbidden that they could not partake of drink or strong drink or wine. They were absolutely forbidden. Why? Because they had to have clear judgment. They had to have clear understanding. And there's a principal lesson there. Because the priests today are not the Levites. And the priests today are not preachers. The priests today, as every member of the Lord's church, is a priest. We don't have to go through someone else to offer our sacrifices, except, of course, Jesus Christ. But you don't have to go to any man to offer sacrifices to God today, because you can do it yourself, man and woman, according to the laws given in the law of Christ. And so just like those priests needed to be level-headed and clear-minded when they offered sacrifices to God on behalf of the people, so do we. We have to have that clear distinction and clear mind when we offer our sacrifices unto God. Purification of women. There was a ritual, there was a ceremony that all women had to go through in order to be purified. We also have the handling of leprosy cases. In the Old Testament, the lepers were separated from the people of God. They were kept in a separate place because they were considered defiled. And also probably for a protection of health that others might not catch the disease, God separated them. But when there was a man or woman who was determined that they had leprosy, there was a trial, there was a system that God put into place to test whether or not they were contagious, whether or not that it was really leprosy or it was some rash or some skin disease. And they would go through this for 7 days, sometimes 14 days. And then if they were considered contagious, if they were considered a leper, they were separated from the people. All those distinctions and all those guidelines are given in the book of Leviticus. The observing of the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement is a very special day in the Jewish law. But it also is very important to us because it previews, it's a shadow and an antitype of the atonement that we would receive from Jesus Christ and how Jesus Christ would do what the live goat did in the Day of Atonement. And we will talk about that in just a moment. It also is other annual feasts. Feast of Tabernacles, what is that? Feast of Booths, what is that? The Feast of Pentecost, the Jubilee, Unleavened Bread, Passover. All those instructions of those festival days are given in the book of Leviticus. There were three festival days that all Jews had to keep, and they had to make a journey to Jerusalem. Those instructions are given in the book of Leviticus. But also in the book of Leviticus, there are historical events. There are historical events that we need to know about. There are few important historical events, but there are some. There are some. Moses consecrated Aaron and his sons for the priesthood. Now, why is that important? Because they weren't just priests. They were the family of the high priest. The Aaronic priesthood was the family of the high priest. That would be the priest of, that would be the family of the high priest until the coming of Jesus Christ. And he would not be of the family of the Aaronic priesthood. He would be of the family of the Melchizedek priesthood, which is something that was before the Mosaic, Levitical, Aaron, and Aaronic priesthood. There was something that was prior in the patriarchal age. And we read that back in Genesis chapter 18. And so the high priest is an important function in the Old Testament worship. But it also is a shadow and an antitype of our high priest, which is Jesus Christ. Aaron offered sacrifices for the people. He was the only one allowed to go into the most holy place, and he was allowed to go in there once a year. And that was for the Day of Atonement. Now, turn your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 10. We cannot talk about Leviticus and not talk about the lesson that is contained in Leviticus chapter 10, verses 1 through 3. You know, in Romans 15, verse 4, the Scripture says, those things were written aforetime, were written for our learning. Here is one of these learning principles that we learn in Leviticus chapter 10. In Leviticus chapter 10, we begin reading in verse 1. It says, "And Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron..." Now, remember, Aaron is the high priest family. They are in the high priesthood. They are the Aaronic lineage. And look at what they're doing. "Took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them." Now I want you to notice something. This was the right priestly family. This was the Aaronic lineage. They were in their priestly garments. They were offering worship to God. But the Bible says, they offered some strange fire. Other translations use the word profane fire. But the key is in the end of verse number 1. He had commanded them not. They offered something that God did not command. What did God do? "And the fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them. And they died before the Lord. Then Moses and Aaron..." Is what the Lord spoke, saying, "By those who come near me, I will be treated as holy. And before all people, I will be honored." So Aaron, therefore, kept silent. What does it mean that by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy? And I will be treated and I will be honored. Here's what that means. These priests were in service to God. These priests were representatives of God and His worship. And they were to guide the people into true worship. They were to be examples of what true worship was all about. And what did the priests do? They changed God's law for something that was different than what He commanded. They offered worship that God did not command, nor had He authorized. Now, in this case, God sends a very strong message that when men change His worship, they do not regard Him as holy. They do not honor Him. They do not glorify Him. And so God will not accept worship that's changed for the sake of change, and He will not accept substitutes when He has commanded the way that something is done. Now, for many, many years, for decades, we have discussed this with our brethren, whom we differ with, say, on the instrument. And they think all the argument is over the instrument. It has nothing to do with the instrument. It has nothing to do with instrumental music. It has to do with authority. It has to do with what does God say? What does God ask for? You see, if it doesn't matter if we use the instrument or not, then why did it matter where they got the fire from? Fire is fire, isn't it? Music's music, isn't it? What difference does it make? Fire from here, fire from there, what difference does it make? Only one difference. God said to get it from one source. You know what that means? That eliminates every other source. That's a principle. That is a principle that God has never changed. Let me give you another illustration. God said in the beginning in Genesis 6, when Noah was building ark, He said to make it out of gopher wood. Now, did God have to go through a list of wood that they did not use? Now, don't use maple, don't use oak, don't use elm, don't use cherry wood or mahogany. No, He didn't have to do that. When He said gopher wood, that eliminated everything else. When He told them in the book of Leviticus that you get the fire from the altar that continually burns, the olive oil that continually burns, that's where they were to get their fire. That was the only source authorized. Any other source was unauthorized. And God made a lesson that He does not accept substitutes. When God said this is what He wants, that's what He wants. And we are to learn that lesson. Now let's move forward to the 21st century. Can we change God's worship today without any consequence? Can we do what Nadab and Abihu did and think that we will escape? Oh, we might not be struck by fire instantaneously. But will God be displeased? Yes, He will. Because He has not authorized it. You see, it has nothing to do with the action. It has to do with the authority. Why do we do it? Where is the authority to do it? That's what this lesson teaches clearer than any other Bible example I know. That if it doesn't matter to change, then why did Nadab and Abihu die? Why? God is able to explain what He wants, and that's all He wants. Nothing more, nothing less. Also in the book of Leviticus, God intended for Israel to closely follow His instructions. Let me give you another example. Why do you give instruction to your children? Did your parents ever give you an optional command? My dad never gave me any of them. Here's what I want you to do, but you do it if you want to. Oh, I'd have loved that. But my dad never did that. When he gave an instruction, that was the law. That was what I had to do. Or there were consequences. You see, I learned that at a very young age. But God taught us that from the very beginning, even with Adam and Eve, we talked about this morning. He said, don't eat of this tree. You can eat of every other tree, but don't eat this one. You see, God gives instructions for a reason. They're to be followed. That's why God gives them. That's why He wrote down this law. That's why He gave all the details in Leviticus. Those are His instructions. Those are His laws. Those are His worship. That's what He wants. And what did He demand of His people? That they obey Him. Is it any different today? No, not any different today. What teaches us that? The Old Testament. The Old Testament teaches that over and over again. When God gives an instruction, He tends for it to be followed. The Day of Atonement. Do you remember what happened on the Day of Atonement? They took two goats. They killed one, put it on the altar, offered it. The other goat was alive. They took that goat, and they would take it outside the camp. And they would take it outside, and the priest would lay his hands on the head of that goat, and he would recite all the sins of the children of Israel during that year. You know, he was out there a long time. But then what did they do with that goat? They took him and moved him away from the camp. Away from where the tabernacle was and away from the presence of God. What was that to symbolize? God taking away the sin. That's a shadow. That's a shadow of what Jesus would do when he died on the cross. He would not do it in a symbolic way. He would do it in a real way. He would not take away the sin in a symbolic way. He would take it away in a real way. Where do you think we get the term scapegoat? That's where it comes from. Leviticus chapter 16. The sins of Eleazar and Ithamar. They were priests and they offered unclean animals and God punished them. Laws concerning the use of blood. Look at Leviticus chapter 17 and look at verse 11. God was very emphatic about this. Leviticus chapter 17 verse 11. For the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is blood by reason of the life that makes atonement. Blood was absolutely forbidden under the law of Moses to drink and to eat. You could not eat or drink blood. It was forbidden. That law is also contained in the New Testament in Acts chapter 15. That has always been forbidden. Why? Because the life is in the blood. You know, there's God teaching us a lesson. Why is the blood to be respected? Because it is the means of life. And if man shed man's blood, what did God say in the book of Leviticus? If man sheds man's blood, by his blood, that will be required. God takes life precious. He is teaching them a lesson. He is teaching them the person, he is teaching them the principle of life, but he also is connecting death with sin. When someone sins, something dies. The animal died every time they sinned. Every sacrifice caused the death of an animal. Every death brought blood. Blood and death are connected to sin. Do you think God's trying to teach us something? Do you think he's trying to make an impression upon their mind? That sin and death are connected, and the blood is the thing it takes to require the sin to remit it. He's teaching us a lesson. Penalty for worshiping false gods. You know what the penalty was under the law of Moses? If you would entice your neighbor to worship a false god, you were to go to the elders of the city, and you were to take that man before them. If he was guilty of the charge, he was taken out, him and his family, and stoned to death. Why? Because he tried to induce God's people to commit spiritual adultery. In the old law, there are 21 death penalties. 21 different infractions that called for the life of those who disobeyed the law. All of them are contained in the book of Leviticus. The fourth book of the Bible in the Hebrew Bible is Numbers. This is one book that we don't like very much because it has all those names in it. It has all those genealogies in it. And it has all those numbers in it. But those numbers and the genealogies teach us something about generations. It also teaches us about generation to generation. And if you compare the genealogies in Numbers and those in Genesis and those in the New Testament, they will give you periods of time. You can add up the years. You can know how long it took certain things to happen. The history of the Israelite wandering in the wilderness is contained in the book of Numbers. The people were numbered at the beginning and at the end. Now why? Why take two censuses? Why take one in Numbers 1 and then take another one in Numbers 26? Well, there's a reason. There's a reason. As the book opens, Israel is still encamped around Mount Sinai, where they've been for nearly 2 years. 2 years? Why haven't they gone into the Promised Land? Why have they been there for 2 years? You don't know unless you read the book of Numbers. You don't know why they've been there that long. They numbered the men who could fight. In just a few months, they would begin to take the Promised Land. And so they needed to know how large the army was. And so they were numbered. Every man over 20 years old that came out of Egypt when they became a nation, they were numbered by tribe. When you add all the numbers up, you get 603,550 men who were over 20. Now that doesn't mean the Levites aren't in that number. The women aren't in that number. And the children are not in that number. And those who are beyond the age of fighting are not in that number. And so the children of Israel numbered much more than over 500,000 people. Conservative estimates say that while they were in the wilderness, they probably were up to 2 to 3 million people. And so 603,000 of them were fighting, of the fighting age. The Levites were not included because they ministered in the tabernacle. Why? They didn't fight because they were working God's work in the tabernacle. It established procedures for organized camping. What does that mean? You know when they set the tabernacle, how did they decide where to set the tabernacle up at? When did they decide? How did they decide when to take it up? When to put it down? How did they decide that? God decided that. When he took up the cloud, that meant to move. And then when the cloud settled over a place, that means that they were to camp. And they were to camp there as long as that cloud was over the tabernacle. And when they camped, the tabernacle was always in the midst of the camp. That means it was always in the center. And each tribe, there were three on each side, northwest, south, and east. And every tribe had their place. Every tribe had a place where they were to camp when the tabernacle was set up. Where are those instructions? In the book of Numbers. In the book of Numbers. This book also contains a number of God's laws that are not contained in the book of Leviticus. We also see in the book of Numbers, Numbers contains laws regulating redemption of the firstborn. The redemption of the firstborn, why did they belong to God? Because he delivered them in the time of the Passover. They were consecrated to God. They belonged to God because he saved their lives. The Levite duties during the moving of the tabernacle. When they moved the tabernacle, there were specific duties that each family had. They are contained in the book of Numbers. Uncleanness. What were they to do if somebody became unclean? There was a ritual. There was something they had to do. They had to go outside the camp. They had to wash themselves. They had to stay out there until evening and then they could come back in. All the regulations are contained in the book of Numbers. Trespasses and restitution. When you made a trespass offering and you violated God's law, you had to make restitution. What would that restitution be? God determined that. And sometimes the judges or the people in the high priesthood would determine what that restitution was. Suspicion of adultery. If your mate brought you before the elders of the city and charged you with committing adultery, there was a legislative way and there was a ceremony that the woman or the man would go through to determine whether or not they were guilty. The Nazarene vow. The Nazarite vow were neither a razor or they don't drink strong drink or wine for a period of time. Now, what the thing about a Nazarite vow, it wasn't a vow that you had to take for the rest of your life. You could take it for the rest of your life, but you could take it for a period of time. But the requirements of the Nazarite vow, they're in the book of Numbers. purification of the Levites. Why did the Levites have to be purified? Because they were guilty of sin. Who's going to offer sacrifice for the Levites? They first had to offer sacrifice for themselves. Why? Because they could not come before God and not be clean. They could not be defiled. So the first thing that they offered was for themselves because they were guilty of sin. Keeping the Passover. Keeping the Passover. The instructions again are given in the book of Numbers. This is how God led the pillar of the cloud and the fire at night. This is how God led them on their journey from place to place within the wilderness. That's how they determined when to move and how to move. Now, at Taberah, some of the Israelites murmured against Moses. Isn't this a pattern? Why did they murmur against Moses? In Numbers chapter 11, they murmur against Moses because they don't have, because the people complain because of the anger of God and the fire of God that consume Nadab and Abihu. They're angry at Moses. Moses didn't do it. God did it. And so they have to be corrected. At Kibroth, they complain not having enough meat to eat. Moses became discouraged at their complaining. What did God do about their complaining about the meat? They got tired of the manna. They didn't want that anymore. They wanted something that had meat in it. Okay. So God appoints 70 elders that are to help Moses judge the people. 70 elders. Does that strike you as odd? That's the same number that's in the Jewish Sanhedrin. 70. They wanted meat. God sent them meat. He sent them quail 3 inches deep all the way around the camp. And it became so loathsome to them, it stuck in their teeth and they got sick of just even thinking about it. See, you might not want what you asked for. You better be sure you want it. God then sent a plague. But ladies and gentlemen, this is a pattern. This is a pattern that plagues Israel her whole existence. She complains, she murmurs when she does not get what she wants. And then when she gets what she thinks she wants, then after she gets it, she really didn't want it to begin with. Kind of sounds like people today, doesn't it? Things haven't really changed too much. Now, but there are some things in the book of Numbers. At Hazeroth, Moses' brother and sister, Aaron and Miriam, speak against him because he had married a Cushite woman. And God takes a very dim outlook. And God rebukes them for speaking against Moses. Moses is God's spokesperson. They wanted to play a greater role in Israel's government. They wanted a bigger slice of the pie. They wanted more say. God struck Miriam with leprosy for 7 days. And it would have been permanent had not Moses interceded on behalf of his sister. God chose Moses that he should have been clear to Aaron and to Miriam. Who chose Moses? Who chose Moses? Who chose Aaron? Who made that selection? They didn't make themselves God's spokesperson. Remember the burning bush in Exodus? Who chose Moses to be the one who would lead them out? Who chose the spokesperson for Moses? Who did that? God did that. They knew that and they should have left it alone. But what about the sin at Kadesh? You see, while they were at Kadesh in the wilderness in Paran, Moses sends out 12 spies to the land. Remember I said, why are they camped around Mount Sinai? Why aren't they moving? He sends 12 spies, one for each tribe, to go into the land of Canaan, to survey it before they go in to possess it. And they're gone for 40 days. And while they're gone, they survey the whole land. What happens? They come back with 2 reports. In Numbers chapter 13 and 14, the men in the land are too mighty for us. They have great walled cities. They have great armies. They have walled cities and the giants, and we're like grasshoppers in their sight. And if we go in there, they're just going to squash us. But there were 2 other spies. who saw the same thing. But their report was much different. It says, let us take the land. Their fear is in them. It's meat for us. And Caleb begged them not to rebel against God. Don't rebel against God. Don't upset God. Let us go in and take the land. He's promised it. And so in Numbers chapter 14, they've got to make a decision. And what do they decide to do? They're going to choose new leaders. They're going to replace Moses and Aaron. And they want to go back to Egypt. And they accuse God of bringing them out in the wilderness to kill them and their children. God said, you don't want the land? You're not going to get the land. And so what God did, only Joshua and Caleb trusted in God and believed in God. They went and got the fruit of the land. They went and brought it back. It was everything God said it was, but there were some things they didn't like. The people cried all night. They murmured. They want new leaders. They want to go back to Egypt. They refused to march against the Canaanites. They won't go in. They won't fight. They won't take the land. Turn to Numbers chapter 14. God sends a swift reply to their stubbornness. In chapter 14, beginning in verse number 28, God's reply is very quick. Verse 27 says, how long will I bear with this evil company and grumbling against me? I have heard the complaints of the sons of Israel, what they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, saith the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do. Your corpses will fall in the wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, that have grumbled against me. Surely you shall not come into the land which I swore to settle, except Joshua the son of Juniper and Joshua the son of Nun. Your children, however, who you said would become a prey, I will bring them in, and they will know that the land which you have rejected. But as for you, your corpses will fall in this wilderness. And so God has made a judgment. God has made a reply that every numbered Israelite that was numbered coming out of Egypt, all 603,550, every one of them are going to die before they enter the promised land. Except Joshua and Caleb. Who does that include? Moses and Aaron. They're not getting in either. But it's not because of this. All who were 20 and older, they would be left in Egypt except Joshua and Caleb. They would die in the next 40 years. So for the next 40 years, they wander in the wilderness. And while they're wandering, that generation is dying, one by one. Until at the end of 40 years, there's not a man left alive except Joshua and Caleb that came out of the land of Egypt. The people see their mistake. Oh, now they believe. Now they got courage. Now they're ready to go. But God said, it's too late. Don't go up. Because if you go up, I'm not going to be with you and you're going to be defeated. They don't listen. They go up and they're soundly defeated. And both attempts fail. They can't invade Canaan, and others seek to return to Egypt, and they can't do that either. You see, God's really in control, isn't He? They got what they wanted. They didn't want the land. They didn't trust God. They didn't believe God. They got nobody to blame but themselves. And then in Numbers 16, if it's not bad enough, 250 priests under the direction of Korah decide that Aaron and Moses got too much authority and they want some of that authority. They're just as good as Aaron and Moses. And so they rebel. And Moses says, okay, you come out here tomorrow and we'll see what God says about it. And so he brings them out and he tells all the children of Israel, you separate yourself from them. You get away from Korah and his priest and you stand away from them. And he brought them out, the 250 princes, the priests with their censers. He brought their family, their possessions. He brought them on. He said, here's what Moses said. He says, now, if you die a natural death, then maybe you spoke righteously. But if God caused some new thing to happen, and you lose your life instantly, then you have spoken against God. What happened? The earth opened up. They all fell in, and the earth covered them, came back together. Let me ask you a question. If you were there, when you witnessed all of that, would that leave an impression on you? Would that leave an impression that it's not very good to rebel against God? It's not very good to call His bluff? You know, I listen to people today tell me, oh, I believe if I see a miracle. No, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't. Here are men and women that saw the earth open up and destroy families, 250 of them, because they rebelled against God. In the next chapter, they're murmuring about water. They don't get it. They don't get it. The earth swallows them up. And if that's not bad enough, then He sends a plague and an additional 14,700 die. Do you think God takes rebellion lightly? Do you think God takes the sin of unbelief lightly? I don't think so. The burning of Aaron's rod. Now He's going to make it permanent. They didn't understand it. Now He's going to make sure they understand it. He brings, tells all the tribes, the head of the tribes, to bring their rods and cast them before Moses. And the next day, when they look at all the rods, only one is budded with almonds. Which rod is it? Aaron's. Where does it go? In the Ark of the Covenant. Along with the two tablets of stone. Along with the pot of manna that fed them while they were in the wilderness. All of them are reminders of judgments God has made. Miriam dies and is buried in chapter 20. Why didn't Moses get in? Here's a man that spent 40 years leading this unthankful, ungrateful, grumbling, complaining, murmuring people. And in Numbers chapter 20, they want water again because they have no water to drink. God instructs Moses to go to the rock and speak to the rock, and it would bring forth water for them and their beasts. I want you to turn to Numbers 20, and I want you to look at verse number 9. And Moses took the rod before the Lord, just as He commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And He said to them, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? And Moses lifted his hand, struck the rock twice with his rod, and the water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. Did Moses follow God's instruction? No. Say, well, the water still came out. Yes, the water still came out. But look at verse 12. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. What sin did He charge him with? Unbelief. Wait a minute. Moses? Unbelief? Yes. Why? God equates disobedience with unbelief. When you don't obey God, that is unbelief. Now let me ask you an honest question. Couldn't have God made an exception this one time? He had put up with those people for 40 years. You know what happened in verse 9? He lost his temper. He got frustrated. He was aggravated with them. Who can, sitting here, cannot understand Moses' frustration with the Israelites? Who cannot understand how he lost his temper for a moment in time? But let me ask you a question. Did God make an exception Because it was Moses and Aaron. You notice what he says? Because you did not treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel. Who did they give credit for the water to? Not God. Moses and Aaron. You see, they took the glory away from God and gave it to themselves. That was his sin. That was what cost him the promised land. But you know, this story has always, always impressed me. Because if God would make no exception for this great man, Moses, he's not going to make an exception for anybody else either. Because surely he could have done it for Moses. Surely Moses had earned it from the faithfulness that he had done up until this period of time. And so he was not allowed to go into the promised land. Moses requests passage through Edom, and it's denied. Edom says, if you pass through our land, we'll kill you. You remember that. God's going to remember that. That Edom will not let him pass through. You remember that when we get over into the divided kingdom. You remember the Edomites. We're going to see them again. Aaron dies on Mount Hor. Remember what God said? You're not going in. He didn't go in. He died up on Mount Hor. His son Eleazar is appointed high priest. The Canaanites take some Israelites captive, but Israel defeats them because God is with them. The people again murmur against God and Moses. God sends the serpents, and it bites them, and many, many die. So what do? The people confess their sin and ask that the serpents be removed. What did God do? God tells Moses to place a bronze serpent on a pole and those who look on it will live. In Numbers chapter 21. You know what that is? That's a foreshadow of the cross. You see, when they looked upon the brazen serpent, when they looked on the serpent, even though they were bitten, they would live. When Jesus is lifted upon the cross, those who will look to Him, even though they've died in their sin, yet they'll live. That's a foreshadowing of the cross. That's a foreshadowing of what Jesus would do when He's lifted on the cross. You see, so many times we make a grave mistake. There is reason behind everything God does. There are lessons that God is preparing for us. These stories are preparing our mind. It is turning our mind to the cross. It is foreshadowing what God plans to do. In the book of Leviticus and in the book of Numbers, God is unfolding His plan little by little. So what if you don't read those books? Are you going to understand about the Day of Atonement? Are you going to understand the parallel of what Jesus did for us when He died on the cross? Are you going to understand why He was lifted up before men? Are you going to have an understanding? Are you going to understand why God charges disobedience as unbelief? You see all the lessons we learn? You see the lessons on authority that we learn? Why do you think God has those books in the Bible? Just to take up space? They teach us valuable lessons. You see, God is teaching us and instructing us that He has a plan. He has a purpose for everything He's called upon man to do. And from the beginning, man has choice to accept God's wisdom, to accept God's pattern, to accept God's way, or to develop another way. But you know what we've learned as we come to the end of chapter 21 in Numbers? That when you change God's ways, it doesn't work out too well, does it? You know what our saying is in our country? Those who do not learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. Is that not so with biblical history? If we don't learn the lesson from the past, are we not too doomed to make the same grave mistakes that they made? You know, I love the Bible. Because when you put the whole story together, when you put all the books and all the stories and all the history, and when you put it all together and you begin to see it all unfold, there's such continuity. There's such harmony. There's such peace. There's such a beautiful picture that nobody can miss it. And that's what God wants us to do. He wants us to know how wonderful and magnificent our God whom we serve is. Brethren, God had a reason for everything He did. God had a reason for every law that He's ever given. God had a reason for everything that He took under His arm to do. And He had a reason for everything He asked Israel to do. He was unfolding His plan, bit by bit, little by little, glimpse by glimpse, leading us to Jesus Christ. And He's doing that through these stories of the law. He's showing us how Israel is going to lead us to Christ. Remember that passage in Galatians? What was the law for? It was our schoolmaster to lead us to Christ. We are on a journey. And that journey ends with Jesus Christ. If you're here tonight and you're not a child of God, no, you don't have to look on a brazen serpent on a pole. No, you don't have to offer an animal sacrifice. And no, you don't have to go to a preacher and confess your sin. You need to come to the great physician. You need to come to Jesus Christ. You need to accept what He did for you when He died upon the cross. He shed His blood that you might have redemption, that you might have remission of sin, that you might have the hope of eternal life. That's why He died. That's why He came. And by believing that, and by repenting of your sin, and confessing His name before men, and submitting yourself to water and grave of baptism, you can contact the blood, not the blood of a goat, not the blood of a bullock, not the blood of a lamb, the blood of the pureless, sinless Son of God that has the power and the ability to take away every sin and to wipe your slate clean. To make you justified, acquitted, sanctified, cleansed, stand before God in a state that you can be accepted and can go to heaven when this life on earth ends. And end it will someday. If you're here and you are a child of God, God loves you. Sometimes we get lost. Sometimes we lose our footing. Sometimes we lose our focus. God still loves us. He's still concerned. His Son still waits. His Son still is willing to take us back if we will repent. Confess the sin. Turn from it. Pray. We will pray with you and for you that God will help you and forgive you, strengthen you, and you can have that slate wiped clean again. You know, the children of Israel, they gave away the promised land. My friend, don't you give away something that's more precious than that. We're not talking about the promised land. We're talking about heaven itself. We're talking about a place that we're all striving to get to. And ladies and gentlemen, there is nothing in this world that's worth missing heaven. Nothing. If we can help you not, we bid you come forward and together we stand and sing.